Welcome to Southeastern Zone, 90.9 FM KSLU. This is Experience Points. I'm MG.
And I'm Red Bear.
We're back again. This is episode 7 of kind of our like mid-semester, our mid-summer nights.
Well, you see, we don't want to put you on hiatus like all the, you know, big commercial guys, so.
Yeah, we're public.
We're right public.
Now.
So we're right here for you.
We're, you know.
All year long, there is no hiatus.
There isn't any. Even if we had a hiatus, we're on iTunes, we're on all
the brakes on this train don't work.
We're on. It's the Snowpiercer train. If you haven't seen the movie, go ahead and look it up. Like we were saying, we're on all the time. What's the website, Bear?
That website is exppoints.com. Always double tap that P.
We have a lot of social media outlets, too. You can go to exppoints.com/Facebook or /Twitter or /Google+ with the plus sign or /YouTube or /iTunes or /Stitcher or /Steam. We're on all of those things. If you ever get confused, though, or, you know, that's a lot of things to remember. You can go to exppoints.com. Scroll all the way to the
double
bottom
tap
page. All of those buttons are down there. Just click on them and they're really cool.
Yeah, clicking buttons is much easier than typing. I'll be honest. I like GUI.
For those new to the show, we are lifelong nerds and we're going to be imparting some of our knowledge tonight on you. We do it every week from 9 to 10 p.m. on KSLU and we're going to do it again this week. We're going to kick it off though real quick with I'll Form the Head by MC Frontalot. He is coming to do a tour. He's doing a big tour, East Coast to, I guess, Middle Coast to West Coast.
Middle Coast, is that a thing?
I guess it's like the border
Gulf
of Mexico.
Coast? Talking about the Gulf Coast?
Gulf Coast is what I mean.
Wow. See, we're nerds, geeks. We don't know world geometry.
World geometry is hard.
It is.
I feel
namely because
like
it's also called world geography.
I feel like some people do it correctly. These people don't know how the real world works. Haven't they ever mapped before?
Nah, bro.
No, MC Frontalot's coming to the Baton Rouge and New Orleans region, I believe, September.
Although I can get you all around Azeroth.
Yeah, yeah. Especially with what do we use? It's not the normal map. It's like carbonite. I think is like
carbonite
thing we usually use. Anyway, I'll Form the Head by MC Frontalot. He's coming here in September, I believe. Check him out. We'll come back in a second. I'm MG.
I'm Red Rare.
You're listening to Experience Points on Southeastern Zone.
90.9 FM KSLU.
Welcome back to Southeastern Zone, 90.9 FM KSLU. This is Experience Points. I'm MG.
I'm Red Bear.
That was I'll Form the Head by MC Frontalot. If you didn't hear, he's coming to the Baton Rouge and New Orleans area later this year, around September. We'll update you the closer it gets, but you can get tickets if you go to mcfrontalot.com, or I think it's frontalot.com. Just Google.com?
Isn't that how you get anywhere on the internet?
Google,
you just go to Google first?
You don't even have to go to Google. It's like built into everything.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah. Now you just start typing questions.
You know what? I think in some browsers, you have to still download the Google toolbar, like the Google search bar. But anyway, it's a brand new week for us.
Browser.
What did you do last week, Red Bear?
What did I do this last week? Well, I got a new job.
Congratulations.
So that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I moved in closer to the studio. So
that's right.
Now y'all got
that's
me
right.
all the
you're,
time.
You're practically local at this point.
Oh, yeah. Pretty much local. The problem with this, though, is I'm between apartments, so all my stuff is in storage.
You only
except
like.
Except for my Game Boy.
Your Game Boy and your laptop.
My Game Boy and my laptop. Yep. So I've been playing some Yoshi's Island.
Awesome. Yep. That's really cool.
That's what I've been doing. New Yoshi's Island.
You've got an ETA on getting a new gaming pad, or you're just kind of waiting out?
As soon as I can. Hopefully, beginning this next month.
Oh,
hopefully.
Sweet.
Hopefully,
so we'll have a big.
We'll see if my new job actually gives me money.
Big video game party. We'll sell tickets. It'll be great.
It'll be awesome.
Experience Points Gaming.
GameCon. Get Red Bear gaming pad.
Red Bear Con 1.
Red Bear Con 1.
Yeah,
wow,
so
that actually sounds awesome.
Red Bear Con.
Red Bear Con. It should be like a DOD type thing.
That'd be nice. Yeah, we can. Yeah, everyone has to wear a uniform.
Yeah.
I think we're turning into Soviet Russia at this point.
Wow.
Yeah, so I got into the Destiny beta. And I think I knew like everyone that was
is
in the alpha.
Is Destiny as good as I'm hoping it's going to be?
And we could probably take an entire show to talk about Destiny.
I mean, if I had a gaming rig, I'd
play. Because we're those types of people where we'll jump on trendy things. Destiny is really, really, really good. I feel like it's a game that, I guess in a short description, it's a game that I could play for a really long time. And
that always makes for a good game.
So it's like the best out of Halo's multiplayer and the best out of World of Warcraft's RPG elements and the best out of the Halo single player game and the best out of Mass Effect. It's like,
okay, so what you just described is the perfect game.
It's not the perfect game yet, but when you add Peter Dinklage
we're in beta.
And Lance Reddick, it becomes a very, very, very good game. It's a very polished game. The only thought that I have is that if the single player storyline is so short, Because I'm okay with the always online type of world, like Titanfall. Right. I'm okay with that. But the single player campaign in Titanfall wasn't really a campaign. It was a string of multiplayer missions that were that was loosely tied with some voice acting to seem like a single player campaign. Mm-hmm. I liked the missions that I've played in the alpha and in the beta of Destiny. The alpha's missions were polished for the beta, and they added two or three extra ones, and it's very, very nice. I see where it's turning into a real game. I worry that this will be the game, you know, 20 times larger than this will be the game. I finished all the missions in about 2 hours, and when you say that an MMO-based RPG first-person shooter game ends in about 40 hours, that doesn't seem like a worthwhile investment to me.
It should end in, what, about 4,000 hours.
Right, right. And to its credit, you know, a ton of MMO games, especially like World of Warcraft, there's a grind fest going on where you have to kill 40 of these boars until you pick up five of these things. You have to kill 20 pigs or go kill some rabbits or whatever, kill some turkeys.
Right.
And I didn't feel at any point that I was just killing things just to get an arbitrary number. I felt like I was doing missions like a first-person shooter typically would.
I was that loser that read all the flavor text, and it's like, oh, these boars have been eating my vegetables.
Right,
and
yeah.
You kill five of them because that magically makes everything better.
It made sense, but then when you realize that's everything, go kill five boars.
Yeah,
like, you know, walk
years
over here.
Into playing the game, you're like, I'm not want to kill these five boars again.
Right, there's no point. They're going to respawn. They'll never run out.
Yeah. Doesn't that farmer realize they just come back?
They just come back. The next guy, you know. Maybe if he thinks, well, you know, it's a balance. That's all it is. But no, in a real short explanation, Destiny is, I think it's going to be a really awesome game. I plan on getting it. It seems people are going to hate on the PS4 because they have an Xbox One. They're going to hate on the Xbox One because they have PS4.
Oh, yeah, that's the whole point. You know, Mopar, Chevy versus Ford and all that.
It would be much better, in my opinion, if Destiny was released on PC. Because then, you know, the gateway would be much broader. People that have a PC that could minimize the graphic settings would be open to be playing, you know, this really awesome game. Versus spending a couple $100 to get a gaming console that really was only going to have three or four really good games for a year and a half.
Right.
So, because right now, you know, the best game for Xbox One or the PS4 is probably the Destiny beta or Metal Gear Solid Ground Zeroes.
Yeah. Well, I'm kicking around the idea of getting a Wii U at this point because I played the new Mario Kart.
It's insanely fun.
It's retardedly. I'm a big fan of Mario Kart. Yep. That's what got me through college. But Mario Kart 8 is insanely fun. I played it at the Nintendo store in New York.
Right.
Insanely fun.
Yeah. I know I've played the new Super Mario Brothers 2 Deluxe Wii U Edition or whatever it's called. And it's very, very nice. I'm very happy with it. I wish that some of the Wii games were convertible to the Wii U.
That's the thing I don't understand.
Because I don't want to have a console that I know the Wii U has the horsepower to play Wii games. Just like the Wii had the horsepower to play GameCube games.
Right.
And then they stopped.
Yeah.
So I know that it can do these things. The fact that they don't is a software gate that really aggravates me.
I hear you.
I
have a whole thing on that because I don't mind the lack of backwards compatibility in a thing whenever you're moving to the future.
Right.
And you just don't want to build the hardware because that adds cost.
It feels like the Wii U is just an HD Wii.
Exactly. And that's what I was circling back to. Is I don't think there's enough of a hardware change to
and that's what bothers me.
Be able to at least emulate the
PS4 not having PS3, PS2, PS1 backwards compatibility didn't bother me. The PS3 had that compatibility, and I realized that I virtually never played PS2 or PS1 games, disc-based games, on my PlayStation 3.
You get the virtual consoles.
I
don't even retro game on it?
I didn't retro game because I moved forward. The games that I really like. I do have a PS2.
I have a PlayStation 1, like the original, you know, gray one.
If I wanted to play a game, I'm going to play it on the original system. Only because
I will say that adds something to it for me.
Yeah.
I really like that nostalgia of loading up the original console.
The fact that you can save at any point in ROM-based, you know, emulators or whatever, you know, that does take away some of the frustration because I left consoles on all night because I didn't want to lose my...
You put signs on it that said, do not touch.
Right. My mother and I were late for church several times because I was trying to get to a save point.
Yeah.
And... one more ink ribbon so I can get to that typewriter in Red Faction or Resident Evil. And save it. But so I got into the Destiny beta, and again, there could be a whole other show on updates to games.
Oh, so what you're saying is looking promising.
Yeah, it looks very, very promising. Peter Dinklage's vocals in the alpha were, it seemed like he was phoning them in, but they seem like they got him in the studio and they actually had some effects, and they've definitely written that wrong, so that's good. Other than that, you know, I've been playing.
They righted that wrong.
They made it right.
They've corrected their mistakes.
They listened to the community going ball all the last time through the alpha.
Communities like to go ball.
Yeah.
That should be a song. Community go ball.
They.
What sound is the
is
community
the ball? It's a CNC. After that, yeah, so I played more of Game Dev Tycoon, and that actually influenced the main storyline or the main topic for tonight, which we're going to get to right after our real quick retro game segment.
Anything
because I feel
influenced
like we,
by Game Tycoon?
Yeah, Game Dev Tycoon. Yeah. Anyway, we'll get to that in a second. But so we're going to cut to another song, and then we're going to get to our retro game, and then we're going to real quick shift over to our main segment. This is 20% Cooler by Ken Ashcore. We played him, I think, 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Yeah, a few weeks ago.
It was pretty good. I'm MG.
I'm Red Bear.
And you've been listening to Experience Points on Southeastern Zone.
90.9 FM, KSLU.
Welcome back to Southeastern Zone, 90.9 FM KSLU. This is Experience Points. I'm MG.
I'm Red Bear.
That was 20% Cooler by Ken Ashcore. Really awesome stuff from that guy. We're not going to waste any time. We're going to jump right into our retro game segment. It's Duke Nukem.
OG. Vanilla.
The original BA.
What up?
The lead character being Duke Nukem. Duke Hit us with Nukem. The facts, Red Bear. What you got?
First fact I got for you. Duke Nukem, the name. They thought it may have been copyrighted. So they actually changed this E to a U for a little while, but then changed it back when they found out it wasn't. You want to take a guess at who may have had it copyrighted before them?
Was it David Lee Roth? Was that his nickname?
No, it wasn't David Lee Roth.
No, was it? Wait, was it? Was it who was it? Was it Reagan? Was he the one that set off
Reagan?
The bombs?
Oh, yeah. Wow, we're going there.
No,
I'm sorry. It was Captain Planet and the Planeteers.
Captain Planet, he's my hero.
I know, right?
He was going to send him down to zero.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Exactly, man.
I know, right?
With our powers combined. Anyway, no, they had a villain on there who was like representing nuclear misuse or something. But it turned out they actually didn't have that copyright, so they changed the U back to an E, and we got Duke Nukem.
Duke Nukem.
Nukem, yep. Released January 1st, 1991.
It's never... Wow, 91. That
91,
was, that
man.
That was a while back.
And it released on the 1st, which is weird to me.
So it was a...
I'm sorry, I misread that. That was July 1st. That makes a lot more sense, because I'm like, whatever releases the first day of a year?
I don't think anything does. There's like some
that
financial
should be a thing.
Reasons. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was released for Windows and MS-DOS. It was MS-DOS at the time.
But now it's on Windows because of Steam.
The original Duke Nukem is the one that people don't really. I guess people don't really like notice Duke Nukem or they're not. How do I say? It's not the most well known entry in the series.
No, I think Duke Nukem 3D.
Duke Nukem
is the
most 3D.
Well known.
Yeah. Because like Duke Nukem had a sequel, Duke Nukem 2. And then Duke Nukem 3 in 96, because we got 3D technology.
Amazing.
It wasn't really 3D. Let's just be honest.
It was that pseudo 3D.
It was like
stuff.
The basic engine. I think that's what it was.
Yeah.
And everything was a flat sprite. There was
exactly,
no 3D
but
models.
You could go around the flat sprite, and there was more sprite than that kind of made a 3D model if you kind of went around it. But you could only look at one face at a time.
There were only 4 actual Duke Nukem games. Duke Nukem 1, Duke Nukem 2. Duke Nukem 3D, and then Duke Nukem Forever, the infamous, the long-awaited triple sequel. But there were spinoffs of this game. There was Duke Nukem Time to Kill, Duke Nukem Land of Babes, and then Duke Nukem 0 Hour for the N64, and later Duke Nukem Manhattan Project, which uses a 3D engine and elements and whatever, but it's side-scrolling from the other, you know, Duke Nukem 1 and 2.
Other fact, there was also a comic book series in 2011 based off of Duke Nukem.
I feel that anything, especially this comic book, would probably have been better than Duke Nukem Forever.
I think I think watching paint dry would have been more entertaining than Duke Nukem Forever.
So we've done this. I think that was our retro game, or maybe not the retro game.
Have we already
game,
made it a retro game?
No, I don't think we didn't make it a retro game. It was a talking point of a previous show where we talked about Duke Nukem Forever.
About how you wouldn't have hated it if they didn't call it Duke Nukem?
Yeah, you know, if it was like a serious Sam game, it would have been fine.
Right,
but,
I think that's the point you brought up. But and another thing, you Duke Nukem, I love this game, not even for the game, but you remember a couple years ago?
It's for America.
Well, it was for America because was your hardware hackable? By that, we meant, could you play Duke Nukem on it?
Right, right, yeah.
We've gotten Duke Nukem working literally on refrigerators.
Yeah, Duke Nukem, I know they came out with Doom, Quake, and Duke Nukem, or Doom, no, it was Doom, Hexen, and Duke Nukem for the...
You could play Doom or Duke Nukem on your hardware.
Oh, no, it wasn't Hexen, it was Wolf 3D. And those were all very similar type games. Wolf 3D, Doom, and Duke Nukem 3D.
Actually, yeah... Jumping over to Doom real quick, I remember having an original, well, not an original, but an iPod Color.
Yep.
And getting Doom running on it with the click wheel.
Yep. So we're going to go, because we're going to talk about Duke Nukem 3D, because that is the most, it wasn't the basic engine, it was the build engine. That is the most, like, well-known version. And it's been on a ton of things. I mean, it was on MS-DOS, Mac OS X, Sega Saturn, the PlayStation, the N64, the Sega Mega Drive, if you can remember that thing.
Wow.
Now it's on the Live Arcade. It's even on iOS and Android platforms. And, of course, Linux, PlayStation 3, and PS Vita. And those PlayStation 3 and PS Vita are coming.
So it'll run on everything.
Yeah, it'll run on everything, on a toaster
and
near
toaster,
you.
Yeah. Something I want to bring up before we jump over to Duke Nukem 3D was the score for Duke Nukem.
Yeah.
Had some impressive names.
Oh, yeah.
Such as Megadeth, Static X, Slayer, Megadeth again.
Two Megadeth.
Corrosion of Conformity.
Double Megadeth.
That's how awesome the soundtrack was. My point is, they had some names and some awesome music.
Yep. I know Duke... Okay, so Duke Nukem... Let's take a break away from the games real quick. Duke Nukem was all about saving some babes.
Oh, obviously.
That was the point in Duke Nukem. There was an overarching plot about... some aliens coming to town, taking up Duke's space, and Duke just had to jump up in there with his, like, size 10 boots and kick some alien butt.
Inevitably, the aliens,
he was all out of gum. There were several stores in the game that he could have
much better to kick aliens.
No, so this game was super violent, very, very, very violent.
No.
Very erotic. There was a ton of, like, eroticism.
As erotic as, like, 5 pixels can be.
Well, yeah,
they,
but I mean,
they got everything they could.
At the time, you know, like Leisure Suit Larry, I forgot about that game. That was a game that, you know, you played and you knew what you were in for. Duke Nukem, it would sneak up on you, and all of a sudden, once it had it, it's like it didn't unload those models. They were there to stay. You can go into questionable parlors.
Establishments.
You can go into establishments. You can give money. It was one of those games, and this is something I miss in video games, and I feel like when they do it now, they're just doing it to copy, where you could literally do anything. If you see a pool table, you could play pool.
Right.
If you see a pinball machine, you could play pinball. If there is a light switch, the light switch works. You could drink from the fountains. You can go pee in the urinal. You could turn on the sink. You could look in a mirror and see yourself.
Which is something I still don't understand why games have such trouble with.
You know what? I think it's laziness. I think
it has to be pure laziness.
It's laziness. But no, to sum up Duke Nukem was like a hero. He's like a Hollywood. In fact, have you ever watched Last Action Hero with Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Yeah, that's a good one.
That's probably exactly who Duke Nukem is. Arnold Schwarzenegger in the movie was, you know, he wore like the same outfit. He always came out on top. He always got the girl. He had a big, nice, shiny gun. Like, he practically
really
was
big, nice,
he practically was Duke Nukem, or Duke Nukem was him. So
One and the same.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, they weren't the same voice actor.
Spiritual successors.
John St. John was the voice for Duke Nukem, and Arnold Schwarzenegger was the voice for Arnold Schwarzenegger.
This is own voice acting.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
But yeah, so Duke Nukem Forever sort of killed it after 15 years of quote-unquote development hell. They released Duke Nukem Forever, and it was largely a bad game.
That's to be expected, honestly. Once you go through development hell, I mean, nothing's going to be good.
I felt like they could have, I don't know, they could have released a better version of Duke Nukem 3D, don't make a sequel, just redo Duke Nukem 3D with modern graphics, and it would have probably been better. But they couldn't do that, so no big deal. Anyway, that's our retro game. We're going to kick it off after this next little segment. This is Airbrushed by Anamanaguchi. Stay tuned because we're going to talk about the North American video game crash of 1983.
Don't go anywhere.
Don't go anywhere. I'm MG.
I'm Red Bear.
And you've been listening to Southeastern Zone, 90.9 FM.
KSLU.
Welcome to Southeastern Zone, 90.9 FM KSLU. This is Experience Points. I'm MG.
I'm Red Bear.
That was Airbrushed by Anamana Gucci. And we're going to break into our main segment. This is the North American video game crash of 1983.
Man, I hated it so much I wasn't alive
you
yet.
You weren't even alive. Neither was I.
I refused to be alive during this crash.
We boycotted life.
That's how bad it was.
It sounds way worse than that's a dark, dark intro. But you know what? Video games used to be much – it was a simpler time then. Video games were much more simpler. In fact, video games were so new, at least in a home console market, they were succeeding very well in the arcade market. But, you know, before we step back in time, let's look at where we're at right now. We talk about video games a lot. You know, obviously, if video games weren't a thing – then experience points would be much more duller because we don't have to talk about...
I think we'd have a lot more tabletop going on. And
yeah, tabletop
maybe some,
and some LARPing maybe.
Yeah,
and
some LARPing, some board games,
some
card games.
We'd be playing some Yu-Gi-Oh! And some Pokemon and some Magic.
Some Magic. Oh, man. Part of me wants to get back into Magic, but part of me just doesn't want to deal with it.
There's too many rules. I just don't understand all of the rules. I feel like I have to play with like house rules, and the house rule book is like a pamphlet. And the normal rule book is like 7 volumes of 1,000
pages. And it comes with
a
free lawyer.
Right, exactly. So games now, we complain a lot about, you know, exclusive DLC or time-based DLC. And we, you know, Red Bear and I talk a lot, you know, off air about what we'd like to see video game, where we'd like to see the market and the industry go. And, you know, we look back, you know, frequently, in fact, we look back, but we talk to a lot of people around us that we work with.
Random people. We just run up to them.
Yeah,
like,
hey, what do you think about this idea? So what about the 1983 video game crash?
You remember that? I don't. I would laugh.
Long story short, we've gotten out of jail a few times. But no.
Worth posting bail over.
Realistically, we look at the past and we talk to people and they don't realize that video games weren't always a thing. That it wasn't just worse video game consoles like, you know, regular Nintendo and then Super Nintendo, and then they kind of just got better.
Right.
It originally, video games started in arcades. And
To make that money.
And it was quarters. It was nickels and quarters. And they were literally nickeling and diming and quartering people to – not quartering like pirate
wow.
quartering.
Yeah.
Second dark intro. No, you'd go and you'd take your bag of money and you'd spend all day
and
at
these
the
games
arcade.
Were specifically designed to – make you have to put in more money.
Right. It was you were paying to waste your time. It was the first MMO.
But you had to go to it.
It was a time sink. And they were awesome. There are some arcades around still today, but not like they used to be in the 80s.
No.
You know,
we don't even have one. We don't have Tilt or anything anymore here.
No. There are no arcades in Hammond.
I spent so much time in Tilt.
You know, you'll find them at a gas station. You'll find it. It's almost like Back to the Future 2 where you see like a Wild West shoot 'em up in a gas station or a parlor or whatever.
Wow. You're saying they called it?
Or, you know, yeah, some establishment like that. So it's not like it used to be. But in the mid 90s, it was still going around where arcades were being phased out. And I remember going to the arcade, especially in the mall at Hammond.
Yeah, Tilt. That's what I said. My childhood was spent in Tilt.
Right. It was more than just an air hockey table and those, you know, those things that you see in like a movie theater. It was bigger than that.
I don't think our movie theater has an arcade anymore.
It does. It does still.
Does it?
Yeah. It's smaller though. But the point being, arcades used to be the big thing. And
yeah, exactly.
At some point, right around 1981 to 1982, the big arcade manufacturers said, I bet people want this in their home. I bet this would be really cool. And thus started realistically the first, but practically, I guess, the second generation of video game consoles. And this was led by Atari. This was led by Mattel, Coleco. Nintendo wasn't even a thing.
Well, they're making cards.
Right. Nintendo was still a card company.
Yeah.
And they weren't making any type of video games things at that moment.
Not at that time.
And even Sega wasn't in it. Sega wasn't in it. Sony wasn't in it. It was Mattel. It was Atari. Activision. You know, a few.
I think Radio Shack even jumped in for a little while.
I know.
Yeah, Radio Shack jumped in.
It was the time period that we're specifically talking about is 1981 to about 1984. It was a good and a horrible time.
Well, it was that time at the beginning when everyone was exploring and trying to figure things out. But then the problem with that works nice for like science and going to space and stuff. But we have businessmen trying to do this.
It was consumer products.
Right, that's the issue.
Consumer product type of thing.
And all the business guys see is money, money, money.
So what happened was...
You see what happened was, kids.
the Atari 2600, which was, in its day, a fantastic console. Made by Atari, it played fantastic games like Pitfall and Joust and, you know, games like that.
Did it play Space Invaders?
Yeah, I think it was Space Invaders.
I know it had Asteroids.
It took a lot of the games that you went and Patriot Command or Missile Command. It took a lot of the arcade games that you would go to the arcade and play, and it would bring it to the house. But the problem was, one, it was unlocked, and we're going to get to that in a minute, but, you know, about unlocked consoles. But two, we started to see that, our businessmen started to see from other companies, it was very profitable to create a video game console. And it wasn't so expensive at the time to create one either. So you had Bally Astrocade, the ColecoVision, the ColecoGemini, which was Atari 2600 clone, the Emerson
Arcadia.
There's
actually several clones of the 2600.
The Magnavox Odyssey, the Mattel Intellivision, the Fairchild Channel F System 2, the TandyVision, the Sears Telegame
Systems.
So many
consoles.
There's just so many games, and it saturated the market for consoles. So, you know, you think you have a problem right now when we got two or three and a half. Yeah.
I mean, because let's be honest, if you're going to get a Nintendo console, you know why you're getting it already.
Right.
I put Nintendo in their own little box.
Right. They don't compete in the same ballpark, at least currently.
Right.
And maybe they don't want to.
I specifically think they don't want to.
Right. But say, you know, you've got two choices or three choices.
Nintendo knows their place and they like it.
PC, Xbox One, and Sony, PlayStation 4. You've got three choices, realistically today, if you're going to game that way. So three choices or four, you know. Game. Back in the day, you had a dozen choices, and all of these consoles were about the same price. They all had commercials that were mudslinging the other consoles, and you didn't really know unless you were in the know. So every console had library, their own separate library. Some of them even created like attachments to play. I know the ColecoVision had an attachment so you could play Atari 2600 games on their thing. So all of that was going on.
Yeah.
And it was just this
licensing
really
issues.
It was this problem with people or game companies not knowing what was going to work and what wasn't going to work. So video games were very in their infancy. To talk about the locked and unlocked consoles, these consoles were completely unlocked, which
was a big issue.
It was a big issue because back in the day, only first-party console or first-party manufacturers would license and mess with their games. So,
sounds terrible when you say it, but then you realize that's a quality assurance thing.
Well, so back in the day, they did it, but only out of habit. Atari made all of Atari's games, but only because, we made the console. But
we don't know how to make the games.
The Activision, big company now, company then. Activision started with four guys who got fed up with Atari's stuff and
that's
left.
That's because Atari pulled some bad stuff
right,
on them.
So back in the day,
like,
I guess
we're not putting their name
in the credits.
The
credits were made by Atari. That was it. There wasn't any royalty. You know, a developer, which it used to be just one-man teams or one-person teams, you would work on a game. You would develop the game in its entirety, and then you wouldn't get one credit and two royalties. So the companies, and that's because everyone was doing it. They could do whatever they wanted because no one had any precedence. But these four guys from Atari said, hey, we're fed up with this. Let's go start our own company. They created Activision, and they took their knowledge about 2600 and started developing 2600 games. And Atari said, well, you can't do that. They sued them, and Activision won.
I didn't think Atari won that.
No. Activision said the court said that they have the right to exist, and if there's no hardware constraints on your console, then they can develop whatever they want for your console. Activision actually started developing games. Activision developed Pitfall. Activision developed, I can't remember the other game, but it was a really, really, really awesome game. I think it was like Pole Position or something. But
Pitfall is a good example, though.
Yeah.
Because that was honestly a great game for that time. Play it now, you won't realize how much thought went into that.
Right. Well, what little they had to work with, the 128 bytes of RAM.
Yeah. But something to pay attention to in Pitfall is the jump animation.
Yep.
Because, like, the dude that made it, like, he had his little brother running around and jumping. He was, like, just watching how he jumped to try to make this jump animation.
It's great to think that this is made by, roughly one and a half people.
Yeah,
a
couple people
on a team. So that's kind of how it was. There was a licensing snafu where all of a sudden, first party, no one wanted to cross the first party, and then Activision did it. And now third party games were all the rage. And everyone
became a problem.
Everyone had the game. game. We already had a hardware saturation. We already had hardware, every type of hardware. You had peripherals that are all crazy. You had consoles that didn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. And then you had games from first parties that weren't fun. They would buy rights to games and then they make unfun games. But then, at least that was first party controlled. Now that third party comes into the mix.
It's the Wild West.
It's the Wild West. Everyone... Quaker Oats had a game.
A dog food company made a game.
Purina had a game. Yeah. What you could do is they had this chuck wagon game where you would chase the chuck wagon. That's what it was. Chase the chuck wagon. You would send in, you would clip out
just
Purina.
Just from the name, you know it's a terrible.
Purina, the proof of of labels, like the proof of purchase. You'd clip them out. You'd mail them in. They'd mail you the game for some shipping money, and you would play chase the chuck wagon. And it was this game that made no sense. It was this horrible, horribly developed game.
And that's fine. But the thing is you had so many, the market was saturated with terrible, horrible, uncontrolled, no QA,
the library was huge. And we're going to get back to the library saturation in a moment. We're temporarily going to step off.
Am I jumping ahead of you?
Hardware saturation on the home console market had to compete with the competition for the home computer market. Because at this point,
PC gaming masters began the rise.
We started getting PCs. We started getting the early Macintosh computers.
And the hardware in these were better than the consoles.
And they were general purpose. So not only were they
educational. Well, that's the thing. You could justify it to your parents.
It was the way that it was described to me that I seem to have understood it was video games. There were games, but a computer was for simulations. And simulations were good when you tell your kids, hey, you're going to run a simulation. Hey, mom and dad, I want to do some simulations. I want to be real genius. You know, Val Kilmer over here, I want to do some simulations. So you get
it's
a
easier
PC
sell to the parents is what it is.
And you know what? You know, it's Commodore 64. You can get the same type of or a bigger system, whether it's from Radio Shack, like a color computer, which was $380, I think. You had the Commodore that was at one the VIC 20 or the VIC 120, which was at $199, and then the 64 was at $499. You can get all of these computers that did so many things.
Like process words.
Right. Well, process words.
Which was actually a big thing, you know, to be honest.
Or you could spend a couple $100 to get the to get a console and there were so many choices.
There was a lot of choices, and older people didn't see a value in it.
Right.
I mean, and a lot of people at the time, video games just started, everyone thought it was a fad. Like, it was going to be gone anyway.
I guess the thing that we really just want to kind of push here is that it was like hyperinflation.
It was
hypersaturation and hyperinflation, because you had so many people, going and pushing new software, new hardware, everybody get out there, and everyone was in it to win it.
Exactly. And the problem is, like I said, it was all these businessmen, companies.
Right. You didn't need to have
any
quality.
No idea what they were doing.
There was no quality in, and businessmen today don't know what gamers want. Don't even know what gamers want. Well, but we've gotten
that's a true.
You know, we've looked at the crash that we still haven't discussed the actual crash. But they've looked back at this. They study this and they know don't do this. Whatever you do, don't do this. So the early days, you had a ton of hardware, you had a ton of software, and you were selling. You didn't need to sell games at say prices like today, $50 and $60 to make bank on your games. Your development costs were so low because you got one guy to do it. They typically made $20,000 to $30,000 a year. You know, you're paying this guy nothing, peanuts, to develop this game. As long as you could sell it for a couple bucks per cartridge, you would eventually make your money back. We're going to cut to a song real quick, and we'll come back, and we're going to finish off the rise and the fall of the 1983 game crash of North America. This is My OCD by Rhett and Link. I'm MG.
I'm Red Bear.
You're listening to Southeastern Zone.
90.9 FM, KSLU.
Welcome back to Southeastern Zone, 90.9 FM, KSLU. This is Experience Points. I'm MG.
And I'm Red Bear.
That was Rhett and Link with My OCD. We're talking about the North American video game crash in 1983. Just to kind of bring you up to speed, they made a ton of hardware. They made a ton of games. All those games, or most of those games, were bad.
And that's just a terrible idea. We have a bunch of bad, terrible games.
That's a really... And with a ton of hardware. So kind of bringing
it
up
to... Play those terrible, horrible games on.
Up to speed. So Atari got these rights to these big-budget games, these big-budget movies.
Seemed like an awesome idea.
It seemed great. Let's start with the first one. The big arcade hit, the breakout hit, was Pac-Man.
That seems like a genius idea. Bring an arcade game that's already successful to the home.
So they have Pac-Man, and they pay a guy. They say, hey, do this game. Make this game. And he says, okay, cool. And
I imagine that's how the conversation actually went down.
He makes the game. He has the source material. He may not have the source code, but he says, all right, I'm porting it to the console. And they say, hey, where's the game? He goes, well, here's the demo. Take this. Look at this. Tell me what you think. Whatever the deal is, I want to get paid royalties for every copy sold. And Atari says, thanks, we're going to make bank on this anyway. So they look at the demo, and someone says, this is so good, we're going to just sell the demo. We're going to put the label on this thing, and that's going to be it. And it's going to be really, really awesome. Well, it wasn't awesome. The game was horrible. It didn't even really resemble Pac-Man. It looked
like
nothing like the original Pac-Man.
That was the problem.
It didn't have the charm. It didn't have the sound. It didn't have the music.
Colors.
It didn't have colors. The ghosts weren't even on the screen the entire time. They would flip around and be crazy. And Pac-Man didn't move smoothly. The dots weren't even dots. They were dashes. And on top of that, the hubris, the arrogance of Atari, they only had at the time 10 million Atari 2600 consoles out there in the market. They made 12 million copies of Pac-Man.
Genius!
They thought that everyone that owned it must have it. They would buy, 2 million other people would buy a 2600 so they could play Pac-Man. So
I'll be honest, whenever I would have been sold on the idea of Pac-Man in my home, I would have bought a 2600.
Right.
And I would have immediately thrown it at them whenever I got this delivered.
So they did sell, I think they sold like 7 million, which meant they had 5 million unsold copies. Maybe it was 5 million. That's what it was. It was 5 million, and they had 7 million.
Yeah. So they had 2 million unsold.
No, it was 7 million because they had 12.
Oh, 12. Wow. Right. I have a math deficiency.
So 7 million unsold copies. So that's the first thing. And the last straw, really, was E.T. E.T. was a huge game at the time. And they paid Steven Spielberg like $35 million to get the rights to make the game.
I mean, and all you have to do right now, people don't even who've never played the game, you just say E.T.
Right, it's like a running joke.
Oh, is that terrible game?
It's like
an urban
legend thing.
Which was true.
They found it.
Yep. They literally buried this game in the desert.
We'll go ahead and we'll post links on the site. But so they talked to a developer and they said it was contracted. They said, "Yo, dude, we have this game. We want you to make E.T. Can you make it in 6 weeks?"
Pro, yeah.
And he says, "Yeah, I can make it in 6 weeks." And I was like, "Well, how good is it going to be?" And he goes, "It depends on the money." So in 6 weeks, and this is 6 weeks for programming, for planning, programming, QA, testing, marketing, packaging, and selling. It was horrible. It was such a flop.
Didn't even make sense.
You didn't have any rules to this game. The E.T. would die and not die and would float and fly around and would fall in holes. And then there was like a park ranger, and it didn't make any sense. Nothing about it made any sense. But what do you expect? 6 weeks for the entire design and development and marketing process.
So much money wasted.
So, what
they
was happening?
The money.
What was happening is in between 1983 and 1985. Because it started to fall in 1983 with all this.
Right.
They went from $3.2 billion, which was that in 1983, to $100 million, which is a 97% drop. 97%.
That means your company's failing.
It was horrible. And that caused a lot of companies to go out of business. A lot of the, video games essentially were dead.
Yeah.
In fact,
We almost lost the video game industry completely.
We almost lost the entire industry. Game journalists were told not to use words like fun and games because the PC market wasn't doing so bad because it had simulations, remember?
Mm-hmm.
It had all these other, word processing and bills and, you can do things with your finances.
You could pay your taxes.
You could pay your taxes and then it would just print out a check or whatever. It had other things going on. But we almost lost video games as a whole due to oversaturation with hardware and software.
Rush titles,
high profile failures like Pac-Man and E.T., and then this idea of it being open and that there was no quality control in that.
Quality control was the biggest thing. And guess who figured that one out?
Who did it?
Nintendo.
Nintendo came in 1985.
Came as our savior. So no matter what you think about Nintendo today, Nintendo saved us.
We wouldn't be here without Nintendo.
We would not be.
They locked down the NES. The game pack was the game cartridges were replaced with game packs,
mm-hmm.
and you had to talk to Nintendo.
You had to get their seal of approval.
Most of the games were made by Nintendo. We're totally first party.
First party mostly.
And they said, if you want to develop for our game, you have to pay us money and you have to prove to us it's worth it. And that's why every Nintendo game, as bad as some of the Nintendo games were, they will never, ever in any way compare to E.T. or Pac-Man. I dug Pac-Man out. I played Pac-Man on the 2600. And you can buy E.T. and Pac-Man for like dollars, $2. And I might shadow box them, things that you should break in case of apocalypse. You break it and it instantly kills you.
Yeah. to make you realize, I ain't got it so bad, I guess.
Yep. you know, the long-term effects of that, you have big companies like Atari, who were, at one point, they were the biggest company in video games. And that virtually killed them. They came back with the Atari 5200. And by the time they came back with the 5200,
it was too late. 5200 too late.
Companies like Sega and Nintendo had already run them over, and the
PC gaming master race was already doing its thing.
It was already doing its thing. By the time their last console, I believe, was the Atari Jaguar,
they tried,
and the Jaguar was a last ditch effort, and it failed horribly. So that's what the video game crash of 1983 was. So no matter how bad you think it is now in video games, it could be so much worse.
It could be E.T. 2.0.
It could be.
Just think about that when you sleep tonight.
Well, on that note, we are going to go to a song. We're going to come back and we'll sign you off. This is Star Fox Corneria Asteroids by Entertainment System. I'm MG.
I'm Red Bear.
You've been listening to Experience Points on Southeastern Zone.
90.9 FM KSLU.
Welcome back to Southeastern Zone, 90.9 FM KSLU. This is Experience Points. I'm MG.
I'm Red Bear.
That was Star Fox, Corneria Asteroids by Entertainment System. We're all out of time here at Experience Points.
Not again?
Yeah, but we'll be back next week. Next Wednesday from 9 to 10 p.m. If you ever get lonely, we're online.
Always
What's
online.
The website, Bear?
That website is exppoints.com. Double tap that P.
We've got all of our audio on there, minus the songs. So if you like what we're talking about,
you can, our voices.
You could podcast us. We're on iTunes. We're on Stitcher. Just go to exppoints.com/iTunes or /Stitcher. You could also check out all of our Facebooks, Twitters, YouTubes. You know, the Google Pluses. You can go there. Go to exppoints.com. Scroll all the very to the very bottom
of the
page.
You'll find the little icons that I'd love to click.
Yeah, they're really great. Also, you can go to exppoints.com/and then just type in like whatever social media you're looking for,
which is a crazy idea.
In fact, we do have a MySpace. I'm working on it.
Are you really? This is news to me.
Yeah.
Did you seriously open us a MySpace?
Yeah, I opened us a MySpace. Wow. So I don't know what we're gonna put on it yet, but MySpace doesn't automate into anything.
All of our content will be on MySpace. We're not going to actually go to any other social media.
That is a possible fact.
That is untrue.
Anyway, we're going to be back next week, so check us then. Thank you for listening. We're going to end the night with And the Songbird Sings by Dan Bull. Really awesome stuff from that guy. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Another week down.
Catch us next week.
Can't wait.
We are, you know, this is episode 7. We're going to be going into episode 8 next week, and then I think we got one or two more episodes in our little...
Till the big event happens.
I think we got 2 more episodes.
Ooh.
And then we're going to be at our 50th. And that's 50th on iTunes, Stitcher, with the co-host.
Not just music. 50 with Red Bear.
No, it's not 50 with Red Bear.
I lied to you.
Nope, season 3.
Sorry, Radioland.
That's all right.
I'll be here next week, though.
We're going to get there.
We'll get to 50.
We've got a bunch of big shows coming up. We actually got our 50th show on our podcast medium coming up. We've got probably like the 40th show with you.
Oh, man.
And we've also got, we've got the 15th.
That's when the show got good.
We've got the 15th year anniversary of the Dreamcast coming up in September.
Wow, so stay tuned for some awesome shows.
We're going to have a lot of little look back. It's going to be really awesome. So we're going to end it on And the Songbird Sings by Dan Bull. Thanks for listening. I'm MG.
I'm Red Bear.
And you've been listening to Experience Points on Southeastern Zone.
90.9 FM KSLU.